Hello, and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. Today at the Learning College, we're going to study Chapter 5 of Henry Ford's The International Jew, published by the researchers at the Dearborn Press, which was the paper put out by Ford's people. And he directed his researchers to research what he called, and is the subtitle, The World's Foremost Problem, The International Jew. Chapter 5, we're going to look at the Jewish political program, particularly for Goyim. That's the title of it. You can find everything we've done at vnnforum.com, and I got suspended in my second Twitter account, the Linder Files. I have a new one at @A_Linder, and I think I will probably always stay on Twitter, even if I get banned, but if not, you can always find wherever I am at VNN Forum. I know Vargas set it up somehow, but go there, you'll be able to find what we're doing. And continue making tweets as a way to condense thoughts, put them into the most memorable form. It's just a good format. The ADL put out a release congratulating Twitter on tightening its rules against what Jews call hate, which is stuff that they hate, positions they hate, or types of people they hate, and also more broadly construing threats, as I understand it. Anyway, so I'm on my third account now, but leaving that aside, let's look at Chapter 5, a fairly short chapter, as most of them are, in The International Jew. The Jewish political program. It begins, as some of the earlier ones have, with an epigraph from the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion. Just listen to this. This is the fifth protocol. We will so wear out and exhaust the Gentiles by all this that they will be compelled to offer us an international authority, which by its position will enable us to absorb without disturbance all the governmental forces of the world and thus form a super-government. And the second last paragraph of the fifth protocol. We must so direct the education of Gentile society, we must so direct the education of Gentile society, i.e. through like public schools and such, that its hands will drop in the weakness of discouragement in the face of any undertaking where initiative is needed. William Pierce, for one, used to lament the lack of initiative in today's modern young white men. So initiative and energy are always very good and necessary things, and the Jews think that by their networking and their hyper-energy, and they are very energetic, and their intelligence, they can rule the world, and the rest will be subjugated to them, and they will use the existing infrastructure or create new infrastructure that they as they need it in order to suppress our kind and to properly train it to be good cattle. And it is the resistance to that that is the reason that we form the Learning College and offer these Vanguard audiobooks, which is reading of the texts of serious works and serious commentary to go along with those texts. So that's the fifth protocol from the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, which you should read because Jews hate it and denounce it. The most successful anti-Jew tract probably ever written, because it gets to the heart of the mentality that clearly is running the world today, or attempting to create a global government, running most of the individual nations. You know, as we see, as I speak in 2015, we get near the end of the month of April, we see all kinds of invaders moving into Europe on boats, and we see the various political parties there openly declaring that they side with the invaders over the natives, the Labour and the Tories in Britain, the various Jew-run parties in France and Germany. So what other place and time in history do you find the vast majority of the natives have no political representation at all? That's how it is when you have an alien hostile minority controlling things and interfering with people's communication so that they don't know what's going on and they're fooled into fighting and helping the invading alien or the native alien interloper. Anyway, Chapter 5, The Jewish Political Program. This is page 61 to 67 of a 230-page book. Not a huge book, but nicely, simply written that all can understand it. And it's a book that the Jews put a lot of pressure on Ford to retract, essentially. And in a sense, he did that. They had him sign, or one of his men signed, in order to relieve the economic pressure they were putting on him. And that shows you Jew power, that they were able to do that in the I think it was the later 20s when they did that. But nevertheless, factual material stands on its own, no matter what anyone says, even if the man who had it compiled later retracts it for private personal reasons. If the information and the facts are solid and the logic tying them together is solid, then the case stands, and so it is with the international Jew and the arguments made therein. So chapter 5, page 61 to 67, we're going to do the Jewish political program. Now I'll read from the text. Theodor Herzl, one of the greatest of the Jews and the founder of modern Zionism, which began as his own concept and culminated in the establishment of Israel in 1948, Theodor Herzl was perhaps the farthest-seeing public exponent of the philosophy of Jewish existence that modern generations have known. He was never in doubt of the existence of the Jewish nation. He proclaimed its existence on every occasion. He said, "We are a people, one people." And this is when there is no Israel and Jews are scattered all over the Western world. And he's saying, "We nevertheless are a nation. We do not belong to France, Germany, England. We are our own nation. And we need to re-establish a territorial nation with sovereignty in Palestine." He clearly saw that what he called the Jewish question was political. In his introduction to The Jewish State, in quotes, that's his book, he says, quote, "I believe that I understand anti-Semitism, which is really a highly complex movement. I consider it from a Jewish standpoint, yet without fear or hatred. I believe that I can see what elements there are in it of vulgar sport, of common trade jealousy, of inherited prejudice, of religious intolerance, and also of pretended defense. I think the Jewish question is no more a social than a religious one, notwithstanding that it sometimes takes these and other forms. It is a national question which can only be solved by making it a political world question to be discussed and controlled by the civilized nations of the world." During this, trying to get Israel established, he's going around and meeting with various heads of states and trying to get them to make promises to him. And ultimately, they basically say that they'll throw the weight of the Jews behind Britain and the Allies in World War I in order for the Balfour Proclamation to help them establish Israel. So they have a lot of pull, even though they don't have a nation state. They're an international genetic criminal clan. Not only did Herzl declare that the Jews formed a nation, but in relating the action of the Jewish nation to the world, Herzl wrote, quote, "When we sink, we become a revolutionary proletariat, the subordinate officers of the Revolutionary Party. When we rise, there rises also our terrible power of the purse." And, of course, he's writing that before the Bolsheviks effect their revolution in 1917 in Russia. The Jacob Schiffs, the Jewish rich financiers, with their terrible power of the purse, to use Herzl's phrase, subsidized Lenin, who was a quarter Jewish, and the rest of the mainly Jewish revolutionaries in Russia, the proletarian scum and its leaders. This view, which appears to be the true view, and that it is the view which has been the longest sustained in Jewish thought, is brought out also by Lord Eustace Percy, and republished, apparently with approval, by the Canadian Jewish Chronicle. It will repay careful reading. Here's a nice paragraph quote. "Liberalism and nationalism, with a flourish of trumpets, threw open the doors of the ghetto and offered equal citizenship to the Jew. The Jew passed out into the Western world." This would be right after Napoleon, the rise of citizenship, where it's not limited by race or religion, but is open to the individual. "The Jew passed out into the Western world, out of his ghetto, saw the power and the glory of it, used it and enjoyed it, laid his hand indeed upon the nerve centers of its civilization, guided, directed, and exploited it, and then refused the offer. Moreover, and this is a remarkable thing, the Europe of nationalism and liberalism, of scientific government and democratic equality, is more intolerable to him than the old oppressions and persecutions of despotism. So the Jew essentially refuses to be assimilated, and even if he's offered entree into this great new world, he still retains his Jewishness. And thus, while everyone else is supposed to assimilate, the Jew retains his identity. And now he has control of the Western society, and not merely through loaning money and living in his ghetto, but from the direct center of Washington and New York, and he's free to go anywhere and do anything and to buy our leaders, as Sheldon Adelson does, and to pass laws preventing the rest of us from doing anything about his power. Quote, in a world of completely organized territorial sovereignties, he, the Jew, has only two possible cities of refuge. He must either pull down the pillars of the whole national state system, or he must create a territorial sovereignty of his own. In fact, he did both. Destroying goy nations, preserving the racial integrity of Israel, and attempting to place Israel at the head of the nations and over them, and the rest of the nations brown, force mongrelized, and under his thumb. In this, perhaps, lies the explanation of both Jewish Bolshevism and of Zionism. No, ostensibly, that where are Jews going to be international socialist or national socialist, like racist in Israel and international? And, of course, they're pursuing both at the same time. They're not at odds. In this, perhaps, lies the explanation of both Jewish Bolshevism and of Zionism, for at this moment, Eastern Jewry seems to hover uncertainly between the two. In Eastern Europe, Bolshevism and Zionism often seem to grow side by side, just as Jewish influence molded Republican and Socialist thought throughout the 19th century down to the Young Turk Revolution in Constantinople, hardly more than a decade ago. Not because the Jew cares for the positive side of radical philosophy, not because he desires to be a partaker in Gentile nationalism or Gentile democracy, but because no existing Gentile system of government is ever anything but distasteful to him. They demand to rule themselves among themselves, and they demand to rule us where they live among us. All that is true, and Jewish thinkers of the more fearless type always recognize it as true. The Jew is against the Gentile scheme of things, says Ford in italics. The Jew is against the Gentile scheme of things. He is, when he gives his tendencies full sway, a Republican as against the monarchy, a socialist as against the republic, and a Bolshevist as against socialism. What are the causes of this disruptive activity? First, his essential lack of democracy. Jewish nature is autocratic. Democracy is all right for the rest of us, for the rest of the world, but the Jew, wherever he is found, forms an aristocracy of one sort or another. Democracy is merely a tool of a word which Jewish agitators use to raise themselves to the ordinary level in places where they are oppressed below it, but having reached the common level, they immediately make efforts for special privileges as being entitled to them, a process which the late Peace Conference, Versailles, will remain the most startling example. The Jews today, and remember this is written about 1921, so right after the Great War, the Jews today are the only people whose special and extraordinary privileges are written into the world's Treaty of Peace. Original published in July 1920, refer also to the present United Nations, editor Gerald L. K. Smith, that's from about 1958. In all the explanations of unless that's from the original editor in 1921, I'm not entirely sure, but we are reading from a reprint from Gerald L. K. Smith, kind of a Christian racialist crusader in the later 50s, I believe, because he interjects a couple things in the text, and Ford's book was put out and written in 1921, apparently. So, in all the explanations of anti-Jewish feeling, which modern Jewish spokesmen make, these three alleged causes are commonly given. These three and no more. 1, religious prejudice. 2, economic jealousy. And 3, social antipathy. Whether the Jew knows it or not, every Gentile knows that on his side of the Jewish question, no religious prejudice exists. He talked about that in earlier chapters. There's no evidence of any opposition to Jews on the religious grounds, though there well could be if Jews knew what even bothered enough to know what goes on in Jewish Talmud and their religious so-called texts. But in fact, there is no opposition. Whether the Jew knows it or not, every Gentile knows that on his side of the Jewish question, no religious prejudice exists. Economic jealousy may exist, at least to this extent, that his uniform success has exposed the Jew to much scrutiny. The finances of the world are in control of the Jews. Their decisions and their devices are themselves our economic law. Economic jealousy may explain some of the anti-Jewish feeling. It cannot account for the presence of the Jewish question, as the hidden causes of Jewish financial success may become a minor element of the larger problem. And as for social antipathy, there are many more undesirable Gentiles in the world than there are undesirable Jews, for the simple reason that there are many more Gentiles. Indeed, even at that time, many Gentiles would hardly have had anything to do with Jews at all. None of the Jewish spokesmen mention the political cause, or if they come within suggestive distance of it, they limit it and localize it. The political element inheres in the fact that the Jews form a nation in the midst of the nations. It is not the fact that the Jews remain a nation in the midst of the nations. It is the use made of that inescapable status, which the world has found to be reprehensible. That is, the Jews could live and act like Amish as a sort of a subset or a nation within a nation, and no one would care, but it's what they do that bothers people. It's their behavior that bothers people, not what they are, not their religion, not the fact that a lot of them are rich. The nations have tried to reduce the Jews to unity with themselves, that is, to assimilate them, but destiny seems to have marked them out to continuous nationhood. It's not destiny, though. It's their willed choice. Almost admirable in a way, were it not the use to which they put their nationhood. Both the Jews and the world will have to accept that fact. The Jewish world program and the political basis of the anti-Jewish feeling which that program creates, that is, the nation of Jews ruling and riding herd over the rest of us, see, they don't want to simply be separate. They want to be separate and superior and boss the rest of us around, and they are only willing to live if they can boss the rest of us around, and they are willing for us to live only on their terms, which means we're as disposable as Kleenex. Anything else is unacceptable to them, so they won't live and let live. And our policy of living and let living and being generally more tolerant and thoughtful, we're simply being destroyed by a more aggressive race. Thus, the more intelligent and aggressive of our race need to come to the fore in order to form a body that can protect our race and destroy this race before they finish destroying us. That's the bottom line. You see, that's why we make these efforts to explain to you what's going on, teach you stuff that you won't learn in a school system that is set up to apologize for the Zionist-occupied government, and to reduce whites to cogs within that system. With Learning College, you get the genuine alternative, and you understand or you learn that the world is a shockingly different place than described in papers you can buy at the corner shop, or programs you can watch on the average flat-screen TV. I don't even know if there are any non-flat screen TVs other than leftover ones. I think they're all flat screen today in 2015. I like to throw that in just to locate this in time and place, because this material is evergreen. So long as Jews are around, it will be relevant. They're not going to stop being what they are. It's long since, as Donald Day and Edgar Steele echoed, gone to seed in them. What they are and what they do have become the same thing if they were ever a different thing. The Jewish world program and the political basis of anti-Jewish feeling, which that program creates, and notice, is exposed by Jewish cosmopolitanism with regard to the world and by Jewish nationalistic integrity with regard to themselves. So 95 years before when I read this, he's describing exactly what came to occur about 27 years after he wrote this with Israel. There are Nazis in Israel. and they're white genocidalists everywhere else. We have to open our borders. They have to keep their borders. It's a double standard, and only controlling the media allows this hypocrisy from being exposed and them being shown to be what they are, Laxists. They hate white people. They want to genocide them. And it's our job in the alternative media, that is media which basically has only one real political meaning, media not controlled by Jews or incompletely controlled by Jews. It's not like we're stopping their sites on the internet from spreading. But here, we are allowed to talk peer-to-peer instead of passing first through a Jewish filter that gets rid of all ideas Jews don't find congenial and only propagates those that protect or push the envelope of the end state they're trying to achieve and have been for hundreds of years. Actually, thousands of years. So it's basically a complete double standard, and only their control of the media prevents us from that being widely recognized. So that's the end of that subtitle, and then there's one more in this chapter. Like I said, it's not a super long chapter. Jewish nationalism and the protocols. No one now pretends to deny, except a few spokesmen who really do not rule the thought of the Jews, but are set forth for the sole benefit of influencing Gentile thought, that the socially and economically disruptive elements abroad in the world today are not only manned, but also moneyed by Jewish interests. So they're supporting subversion with their money and their media, the twin pillars of their political power. For a long time, this was held in suspense owing to the vigorous denials of the Jews and the lack of information on the part of those agencies of publicity to which the public looked for its information. So essentially, he's outing the earlier George Soros's of that time, the Jacob Schiffs, people who are funding Edward Bernays, the father of PR, the relative of Freud, creating these campaigns to mass herd the Goyim in the desired direction, the War Control Board in World War I, or the Production Control Board, whatever it was called, the nationalization of all policy, the centralization of immense political power that had always been, by wise foresight of our founders, had been decentralized, the Jewing of the country that was taking place institutionally from 1900, say, on, and you see the creation of the progressive income tax, the IRS, the cartelization of banking through the Federal Reserve Act and formation in 1913. All this is the centralization of economic and political power, which serves the Jew who is coming into the country for the first time in great numbers after 1980. But now the facts are coming forth. Herzl's words are being proved true. Quote, when we sink, we become revolutionary proletariat, i.e. communist, the subordinate officers of the Revolutionary Party. These words were first published in English in 1896, and there was a big Jewish working class, like labor or working men. They would typically be called, Lower East Side of New York, the garment district, Jews working in trades. We don't think of them as working in trades today. Today they would be on the higher end, like, what is it, Dove Charnel or American Apparel. They'd be owning those things, but back then they'd have a whole district where the Jew would have his little sewing machines and work various Jewish women, and they produce garments and sell them. And that's how a lot of the original retail apparel fortunes were made, and a lot of those names that rose to prominence. The Jews came out of that background, and part of that was labor organizing, and that's where the ideas of Marx were spread, the Marxist in New York City. And of course, there was a two-way flow. As transportation improved, radicals would come over here from Russia, very different from the native stock who founded the U.S., who were Northwestern Europeans, either German farmers like my people, or British farmers, or prisoners or preachers, or like others of my relatives, and most of you listening to this also. It's basically a British German descended country. But after 1880, we started taking large numbers from Southern and Eastern Europe, and that meant tremendous amounts of Jews, and these Jews were infected with the radicalism that was trying to depose and murder the Romanovs, as it eventually did, and was fomenting various revolutionary attempted putches and during the 100 years, or at least the 60, 70 years before the successful revolution in 1917. So we're taking this element into the U.S., and it's building up, it's laboring, it's working, it's saving money, it's gaining contacts with local financiers in Wall Street, and it's going back to Russia with pockets full of money, and it's soon enough they're able to carry off the revolution. You see, this is how it works. I know I keep going over the same thing, but it's important to understand this. And this book, The International Jew by Henry Ford, one of America's prime industrialists, created a new industry out of scratch, the car industry. There were a lot of car manufacturers, but he created the process by which pay workmen an outrageous sum a day, like $5 a day, I think it was, he was famous for, in order to get their loyalty and commitment. And then they had put out a really good car. And this really, they routinized the production of the car. They had it down to a real science. But back then, businessmen had other interests that were more intellectual. They were not just cutting a high figure in society or doing philanthropic work, but they were actually into eugenics. They were actually into what was good for the country. And you always remember what Kevin McDonald said. It wasn't big business who tore down America's borders. It was Jews. Jews alone. As he proved in his essay. And then after Jews tore down our took control in our country, and they're essentially the American Revolution in the 1960s, the Cultural Revolution, they passed a bunch of globalization laws that effectively mean that any company with more than 15 or 50 employees is forced to go along with the Jewish political program. And eventually, when enough companies are doing this, the large ones at some point don't mind doing this because it blocks competition from the smaller companies who could threaten them. And so essentially it's more cartelization, or if not a monopoly, then a duopoly, or just a handful of giant firms are doing tremendous contracting business with a giant centralized government. That's the irony of it. It's just like Republicans, Democrats, two fake solutions that are really have the same agenda. These giant companies, when the government is big enough, people say, oh, the corporate stuff is evil. The corporate stuff only has the power because government is giving it contracts and preventing competition. Like if you're some little guy and you have an idea, say you're a chemist and you want to create a new kind of pill that might help people, you can't do that because you have to have regulation, and effectively you're barred from entering the market. So that market access for new pills or healing technologies is only possible after these billion-dollar trials that only a handful of the very largest companies in the world can carry out. You say, well, that means safety. Well, no, it doesn't mean safety, because plenty of these approved pills, even when they work correctly, they have terrible side effects, including on nearly every single one, death. Now, if you're intellectually honest, you realize that that means that there is no genuine safety. All you do when you create these bureaucracies that supposedly bring people is you empower the bureaucrats. Who are the bureaucrats? Well, they're always people. They're typically David Kessler, you know, who's a MD, and I forget what his other thing was. They're the ones deciding what everybody else can do with their body, what they can buy. You should be able to go to the store and buy whatever the heck you want, but that's far too frightening for the people who want to control everything. They want all the profits flowing into their pockets. The market is the only successful regulation that you're going to find, because the market lets other people who think they can do it better go in there and prove it. And the people who already have the power and who have the income don't want any competition, and that's precisely what bureaucracy affords them. It doesn't guarantee that what they do is fine and good and wonderful. It guarantees that they essentially have the market to themselves, regardless of whether their thalidomide kills people. But we begin to verge too far abroad. But anyway, the America did not have a giant centralized government before all these wars in the 20th century. It had them after that and in between. This notion arose that the government is responsible for everyone's health, education, welfare, and all of their schooling, and paying their medical bills, and paying their retirement, and what have you. And this is popular, of course, with the least competent whites out there. You see, socialism is inherently anti-white because it's giving people, it's basically saying, okay, you're not competent to run your own life. You need to be managed like an ant or like livestock by the centralized government, who are effectively your spiritual parents. They'll take half your money and tell you what's good for you, and they'll call it free and safe. And you go, yay, just like a bunch of kindergartners. We have everything that's free and safe. It's not like that in reality, but the fib fooled the child. It's kind of a secular Christian fantasy of safety and security, and everything is being arranged for your benefit. But in fact, the government is simply the gang of people with its own agenda and the ability to mess up anyone who gets in the way by wanting to keep their own money. And this is not what America was originally conceived to be. And it's no example. It's no surprise that when you had small government, you had virtually no central government, you had all kinds of super intelligent British descended people, and now you have a bunch of garbage people. Your average person is an obese idiot who has more education than, say, Ben Franklin had back then, but is 100 times stupider and is dependent on 51 different benefits and all kind, taking all kinds of pills and eating the wrong food. These things all hang together one way or another, and Jews know how to manipulate them for their own interest. And when all this power is centralized, well, it's to the advantage of a small minority. Because, you know, like the guy said, give me a lever long enough and I'll move the world. If everything is dictated out of Washington, D.C., then all Jews have to do is control Washington, D.C., and they control the entire continent. And that's how it is today. And they have their pod factories in all the public schools where they roll their own. They create the kind of people who can't recognize them for what they are, and who are taught all the going propaganda lies, even though they're anti-white and a lot of these students are white, they still swallow it down because that's how most people are. All right, back to the text. So, again, the Jewish tendency to have it both ways. They want racist Israel because they need safety, but they want to destroy your country because that's fairness and equality and democracy, and they don't care if you need safety, i.e. to be protected from the blacks who are currently now raging in Baltimore, rioting there over this weekend. That's unjustified. Any kind of safety you want, you are to be force mongrelized out of existence. They are to retain their racial integrity and rule mongrelized Jews for all times. That's the Jewish political program, which is the subject and title of this chapter 5. And again, written in 1921, back to the text, just now these tendencies are working in two directions, one for the tearing down of Gentile states all over the world, the other for the establishment of a Jewish state in Palestine. Yes, it continues that way. The latter project engaged the attention of the whole world. The Zionists make a great deal of noise about Palestine, but it can scarcely be designated as more than an unusually ambitious colonization scheme. And just 27 years after this was written, it would come into existence. The Jewish home idea, so sedulously cultivated, is a very useful smokescreen for the confiscation of the immeasurable sources of mineral and oil wealth. It is also serving as a very useful public screen for the carrying on of secret activities. International Jews, the controllers of the world's governmental and financial power, may meet anywhere at any time in war or peace, and by giving out that they are only considering the ways and means of opening up Palestine to the Jews, they easily escape the suspicion of being together on any other business. So they're colluding for a number of Jewish agenda items, but the idea of establishing a Jewish homeland in Palestine offers them a good pretext for escaping attention. Though Jewish nationalism exists, its enshrinement in a state to be set up in Palestine is not the project that is engaging the whole Jewish nation. The Jews will not move into Palestine just yet. They will not move in at all merely because of the Zionist movement. Quite another motive will be the cause of the exodus out of the Gentile nations when the time for that exodus fully comes. And he's writing this 12 years before Hitler takes power. I think when Hitler had just begun to agitate following World War I, the world has long suspected, at first only a few, then the secret departments of governments, next the intellectuals among the people, now more and more the common people themselves, that not only are the Jews a nation distinct from all other nations, and mysteriously unable to sink their nationality by any means they or the world may adopt to this end, but that they also constitute a state. That is, they are politically organized. And think we have the annual Congress of the meetings of the heads of major Jewish organizations. So there's 300 Jewish organizations are having a meeting at this Congress. They have a literal blueprint. Well, it's not a literal architectural blueprint, but a political plan for the future of the Jewish people. What do whites have? They have me talking to you. They have Lindsey Graham, who is a veiled faggot conservative whose donors are exclusively pro-Israel, so that he said if he appointed a cabinet, it would be 100% Israelis or Zionists. So we're not even on the field competing with these people. They've completely co-opted our political class and subverted us. They've really turned us out, as the niggers would say in prison. So he's saying that people have come to suspect that Jews are not only a nation, that is a distinct group that sees itself as such, but they are actually constitute a state. That they are nationally conscious, not only, but consciously united for a common defense, for a common purpose. Revert to Herzl's, and remember, they were back then, but it's kind of like what I say about Christianity. We didn't have the easy transportation to where these people could, at a moment's notice, all fly around the world to, say, gather in Washington, D.C. for the AIPAC meeting each spring. So there wasn't as much evidence as there would be today because the communications, electronic technology was just coming around and the transportation has not quite arrived to allow it to become obvious that they're a state within a state, that they have their own organizations, they have their own agenda, and they're 100% pro-Jewish and anti-white. All this was suspected back then, but it was not as easy to prove. Literally because people couldn't so easily electronically or physically get together as they can now. Which brings out not only the true dangers always latent and inherently ineradically existent in Christianity, i.e. its anti-white universalism, but also the true and genuine nature and plans of the Jews as a subset of hominids. Revert to Herzl's definition of the Jewish nation as held together by a common enemy, and then reflect that this common enemy is the Gentile world. Essentially, you're either a Jew or you're an anti-Semite. Does this people, which knows itself to be a nation, remain loosely unorganized in the face of that fact? It would hardly be like Jewish astuteness in other fields. The interest of the protocols is their bearing on the questions. Have the Jews an organized world system? What is its policy? How is it being worked? What plans do they have for themselves? And what plans do they have for us? These questions all receive full attention in the protocols. Whosoever was the mind that conceived them possessed a knowledge of human nature, of history, and of statecraft, which is dazzling in its brilliant completeness, and terrible in the objects to which it turns its powers, if indeed one mind alone conceived them. It is too terribly real for fiction, too well sustained for speculation, too deep in its knowledge of the secret springs of life for forgery. Jewish attacks upon it thus far make much of the fact that it came out of Russia. That is hardly true. It came by way of Russia. That is, it's not from Russia. The internal evidence make it clear that the protocols were not written by a Russian, nor originally in the Russian language, nor under the influence of Russian conditions, but they found their way to Russia and were first published there by about 1905... Remember, ill-fated attempted Jew revolution in Russia in 1905. So these protocols somehow made their way to Russia by 1905 and were published there by a professor Nilus, N-I-L-U-S, who attempted to interpret the protocols by events then going forward in Russia. They have been found by diplomatic officers in manuscripts in all parts of the world. Wherever Jewish power is able to do so, it has suppressed them, sometimes under the extreme penalty. Their persistence is a fact which challenges the mind. Sheer lies do not live long. Their power soon dies. The protocols are more alive than ever. And I will say, in reading them, they give you a sinking feeling in your stomach. The way only one other thing I've ever read did, which was Freud, Civilization as Discontents, the first time I read it. Read them and feel their meaning. We make too much sometimes of the logical because, of course, it's underemphasized everywhere else and deliberately as a result of anti-mentational patterns of thought that are promoted in public schools precisely for the anti-white agenda I've described above. It protects Jews when Gentiles don't know how to think and indeed have been trained to kind of reverse think. The feelings are everything, but sometimes taking your general impression of like how things are going, why does everything conduce to the same end, and feel what's intended, and the protocols really lays that out and creates in you a feeling of utter horror. Utter horror. A sinking feeling in my stomach was what I felt when I first read the protocols. It was almost too much to bear. And we will get to the protocols on our audio broadcast here for the Learning College as we move forward. Their persistence of the protocols is a fact which challenges the mind. Sheer lies do not live long. Their power soon dies as they're exposed. The protocols are more alive than ever. They have penetrated higher places than ever before. They have compelled a more serious attitude to them than ever before. The protocols are a world program. There is no doubt anywhere of that, whose program is stated within the articles themselves. But as for outer confirmation, which would be the more valuable, a signature or six signatures or 20 signatures or a 50-year unbroken line of effort fulfilling their program. So, what you see in the real world reflects what they describe in there, regardless whether you want to call it fiction, forgery, or fact. They fit what's going on. The point of interest for this and other countries is not that a criminal or a madman, quote-unquote, conceived such a program, but that, when conceived, this program found means of getting itself fulfilled in its most important particulars. The document is comparatively unimportant. The conditions to which it calls attention are of a very high degree of importance. And there ends chapter 5. So, there is, the Jews are a nation, that is, they are a genetic people that feels itself to be related as well as is genetically related, even to the point of having, check out Jewish gen, having Jew-specific diseases, but it's also organized as a state within a state. It's not just a nation. It has actual political organization, even when it's spread out before the creation of Israel. It acts as one team that is hostile to all other people, and not content merely to live alone, differently and superior to them, richer than whatever, but demands to ride herd on them, to boss them around as kings, and submit the rest of the world to its yoke as slaves. And its program is essentially written out in protocols. And that really pretty much sums up chapter 5. And so we've made our way now through half of the book. Well, no, that's not true. We've made our way through about a third of the book. Slightly under a third of the book, even though we've made our way through half the chapters. I think there are only... Oh, I was thinking there were 9 chapters. No, that's not right. There are... Mm-hmm. 15 chapters, and we've made our way through one-third of the book, so we've just finished chapter 5. All right, my name is Alex Linder. You can follow me at @A_Linder on Twitter, and you can always go to VNN Forum. That will be up forever. That will never be fired or anything, and... That's where you can always find the latest of what I'm up to and what we are up to, more importantly, as we build a white head and build a white body of resistance to this attempted Jewish takeover of the world and subjection of our race to ignominious and genuinely miserable slavery and forced assimilation via mongrelization into a white genocide. That really is what it amounts to. It's necessary to see the biggest context, and that's what we're doing here. We're fighting white genocide with white renaissance, white rebirth through white consciousness. Do you see that you are of a different race? You are of a race. You want a race with a future. You want a future for your grandkids. The basis from which that can be done is racial, not religious, not anything else. Racial, not cultural, not political, not whatever. Racial. So thanks for being with me again today, and I will be back with you again real soon.